white where the snow had settled, and stained dark further in where the heat of the room had melted the crystals back into water again. Outside, the city was a mass of half-unseen grey shapes. Ordered lights ran in lines and curls, dimmed by distance and passing flurries. Darkness came like a black flag waved over the canyon, drawing back the greyness from the shores of the city, then pushing forward the individual specks of street and building lights as though in recompense. The silent screen and silent snow conspired. Light flung a path into the silent chaos of the fall beyond the window. He got up and closed the doors, the shutters and the curtains. The next day was bright and clear, and the city could be seen sharply as far as the canyon's broad curve would allow. Buildings and lines of roads and aqueducts stood out as though freshly drawn, gleaming like new paint, while cold, keen sunlight rubbed a shine into the dullest grey stone. The snow lay over the top half of the city. Below, where the temperature stayed more level, the snow had fallen as rain. There, too, the precise new day was displayed. He looked down from the car and studied the sight. Every detail delighted him. He counted arches and cars and traced the lines of water and road and flue and track through all their convolutions and hidings. He inspected every flash of reflected sunlight, squinted at every dot of wheeling bird, and noted every broken window through the very dark glasses. The car was the longest and sleekest of all those he'd bought or hired. It was an 8-seater with a huge, inefficient rotary engine driving both rear axles, and he had its collapsible slatted hood down. He sat in the back and enjoyed the feel of the cold air on his face. The terminal earring beeped.
"Sir Calway?"
"Yes, Dizziat," he said. Talking quietly, he didn't think the driver would hear him over the windrow. He raised the screen between them anyway.
"Hello. Good. A very slight time delay from here, but not much. How's it going?"
"Nothing yet. I'm called Stabberind, and I'm causing a fuss. I own Stabberind Airlines, there's a Stabberind Street, a Stabberind Store, a Stabberind Railway, Stabberind Local Broadcasts. There's even a cruise liner called the Stabberind. I've spent money like hydrogen, established within a week a business empire most people would take a lifetime to set up, and I'm instantly one of the most talked about people on the planet, maybe in the cluster."
"Yes, but sure..."
"Had to take a service tunnel and leave the hotel by an annex this morning. The courtyard's crammed with press." He glanced over his shoulder. "I'm amazed we really seem to have shaken the hounds off." "Yes, sure, damn it. I'm probably putting the war off all by myself just by being this crazy. People would rather see what I'm going to squander my money on next than fight."
"Sir Calway, Sir Calway," Smar said. "Fine, great. But what is all this supposed to do?"
He sighed, looked out at the derelict buildings speeding by to one side, not far under the rimrock. "It's supposed to get the name Stabberind into the media, so that even a recluse studying ancient documents will get to hear the name."
"And?"
"And there was something we did in the war, Beishai and I, a particular stratagem. We called it the Stabberind strategy, but only between ourselves, strictly between ourselves. It only meant anything to Beishai because I explained about its origin. If he hears that word, he must wonder what's going on."
"Sounds like a great theory, Sharadanin. But it hasn't actually worked, has it?"
"No." He sighed, then frowned. "There is media input to this place he's in, isn't there? You're sure he's not just a prisoner?"
"There is network access, but not directly. They've got it well screened. Even we can't see exactly what's going on. And we are certain he's not a prisoner."
He thought for a moment. "How's the pre-war situation?"
"Well, the full scale still looks inevitable, but the likely lead time's increased by a couple of days, to 8 to 10, after a viable trigger event. So far, so good, to be optimistic."
He rubbed his chin, watching the frozen waters of an aqueduct slide past, 50 meters beneath the turnpike.
"Well," he said, "I'm on my way now to the university. Breakfast with the dean. I'm setting up the Stabberind Scholarship, and the Stabberind Fellowship, and the Stabberind... chair." He grimaced. "And maybe even the Stabberind College. Perhaps I should mention these stupendously important wax tablets to the man as well."
"Yes, good idea," Smar said after a short pause.
"Okay." I don't suppose they have any bearing on what Beishai's got his nose buried in, have they?
No, Smar said. But they'd certainly be stored in the same place he's working. I guess you could reasonably ask to inspect their security arrangements down there, or just want to see where they'd be kept.
All right. I'll mention the tablets.
Check the guy hasn't got a weak heart first.
Here, Dizziet.
One other thing. That couple you asked us about, the ones that came to your street party?
Yeah.
Their governance. That's the term they use for major local stockholders who tell the corporate chiefs.
Yes, Dizziet, I remember the term.
Well, these two are Sulatols, and what they say goes. The chief execs will almost certainly do exactly as they suggest as far as Beishai is concerned, and that means the official government will too. They are also, of course, effectively above the law. Don't mess with them, Sheratnin.
Me? He said innocently, smiling to the cold, dry wind.
Yes, you. That's all from this end. Have a nice breakfast.
Bye, he said.
The city slid past. The car's tyres made hissing, tearing noises on the dark-surfaced turnpike. He turned up the heating in the footwell. This was a quiet part of the Undercliff Road. The driver slowed for a sign and some flashing lights ahead, then almost skidded at the sudden diversion sign and emergency road markings that turned them off the road, over a ramp and down onto a long concrete channel with sheer walls. They came to a steep rise with only sky visible beyond, the red lines indicating the diversion led over the summit. The driver slowed, then shrugged and gunned the engine. The hump of concrete raised the nose of the big car, hiding what was on the far side. When the driver saw what was over the concrete summit, he shouted in fear and tried to turn and brake. The big car tipped forward onto the ice and started to slide. He had been jolted by the turn and then annoyed that the view had been taken away. He looked round at the driver and wondered what was going on. Somebody had diverted them off the turnpike and onto a storm drain. The turnpike was heated and didn't ice up. The storm drain was a sheet of ice. They had entered near the top through one small sluice out of several dozen spread in a semicircle. The broad drain led down into the depths of the city, crossed by bridges for over a kilometre. The car had partially turned as the driver came over the top of the sluice baffle. The vehicle was sliding down sideways, its wheels spinning and engine roaring, lumbering on and on down the steepening expanse of the drain and rapidly picking up speed. The driver tried to brake again, then attempted to go into reverse, and finally tried to steer towards the slab-high sides of the drain. But the car was slithering down faster all the time, and the ice provided no purchase. The car's wheels shook, and the whole body shuddered as it hit ridges in the ice. The air whistled, and the side-on tyres whined. He was staring at the sides of the drain, whirling by at a ridiculous speed. The vehicle was still slowly turning as it skidded. The driver screamed as they headed for a massive bridge support. The rear of the car banged, and the whole vehicle leapt as it battered into the concrete. Bits of metal flew into the air and crashed into the ice behind, then started skidding down after them. The car was spinning faster now in the other direction. Bridges, tributary drains, viaducts, overhanging buildings, aqueducts and huge pipes spanning the drain all flashed by the revolving car, hurtling past in the bright light. Some shocked white faces gasping from parapets or open windows. He looked forward and saw the driver opening his door.
"Hey!"
he shouted, reaching forward to grab the man. The car thundered over the uneven ice. The driver jumped. He flung himself into the front, just missing the driver's ankles. He landed down at the pedals, grasped at the levers and controls, and tugged himself into the driver's seat. The vehicle was turning faster, jolting and screaming as it hit ridges and raised metal grills set in the slope. He glimpsed one wheel and various bits of bodywork bouncing away behind him. Another teeth-chattering contact with a bridge support ripped an entire axle free. It flew into the air and exploded against an iron leg supporting a building, dislodging bricks and glass and scattering metal like shrapnel. He grabbed the steering wheel. It flopped about uselessly. He had the idea of keeping the car pointing forward if he could, until the gradually increasing temperature further down the canyon provided a wet rather than icy slope. But if there was no steering, he might as well jump off too. The wheel thumped and burned his hands as it turned. The tyres squealed wildly. He was thrown forward and his nose hit the wheel. That felt like a dry patch, he thought. He looked ahead, down the slope where the ice was becoming patchy, hugging the shadows of buildings where the shade fell across the spillway. The car was almost straight. He grabbed at the wheel again and tramped the brake. It didn't seem to do anything. He pedaled reverse instead. Now the gearbox screamed too. His face wrinkled at the appalling noise, his feet juddered on the quivering pedal. The wheel came alive again, for longer, and he was thrown forward once more. This time, he kept a hold of the wheel and ignored the blood streaming from his nose. Everything was roaring now. The wind and the tyres and the body of the car, his ears popped and throbbed with the rapidly increasing air pressure. He looked ahead and saw the concrete was green with weeds. Shit! He yelled to himself. There was another lip ahead. He wasn't near the bottom yet. There was another length of slope to come. He recalled the driver mentioning tools inside the front passenger bench. He hauled the seat up and grabbed the biggest piece of metal he could see, then kicked the door open and jumped. He slammed into the concrete, almost losing his grip on the metal tool. The car started to slew in front of him, leaving a last patch of ice and hitting the section of the slope covered by weed. Curved fountains of spray leapt from its remaining wheels. He rolled over onto his back, spray hissing up into his face as he slithered down the steep, weeded slope. He held the metal tool in both hands, clamped it between his chest and upper arm, forced it down into the concrete under the water and weeds. The metal thrummed in his hands. The spillway lip swept up towards him. He pressed harder. The tool bit into the rough concrete, shaking his whole body, jarring his teeth and his vision. A tight wad of ripped-up weed grew under his arm like some mutant hair. The car hit the lip first. It somersaulted into the air and started tumbling, disappearing. He hit the lip and almost lost his hold on the tool again. He rose and slowed, but not enough. Then he was over. The dark glasses sailed off his face. He resisted the urge to grab at them. The spillway continued for another half kilometre. The car smashed upside down into the concrete slope, scattering debris which continued skidding down towards the river at the bottom of the canyon's great V. The gearbox and remaining axle parted company with the chassis and bounced into some pipes, straddling the drain, fracturing them. Water poured out. He went back to treating the metal tool as though it was an ice axe and slowly reduced his speed. He passed under the fractured pipes, which were gushing warm water. What, not sewage, he thought, brightly. Today was looking up. He looked perplexed at the metal tool still vibrating in his grip and wondered exactly what it was. Probably something to do with the tyres or starting the engine, he decided, looking around. He negotiated one final spillway lip and slid gently into the shallows of the broad river Lotol itself. Bits of the car had already arrived. He stood up and squelched ashore. He checked there was nothing else coming down the spillway that might strike him and sat. He was shaking. He dabbed at his bloody nose. He felt bruised from the battering in the car. There were some people staring at him over the top of a nearby promenade. He waved at them. He stood up, wondering how you got out of this concrete canyon. He looked up the spillway, but could see only a short way. A final lip of concrete blocked the rest of the view. He wondered what had happened to the driver. The concrete lip he was looking at formed a dark bump against the skyline. The bump hung for a few seconds, then came down on the thin coating of water that floated down the slope, staining it red. What was left of the driver skidded past him and bumped into the river, edging past the chassis of the shattered car and setting off downstream, swirling pinkly in the water, revolving. He shook his head. He brought his hand up to his nose, waggled the tip experimentally, and gasped with pain. This made the 15th time he'd broken his nose. He grimaced into the mirror, snorting back a mixture of blood and warm water. The black porcelain basin swirled with gently steaming suds, pink-flecked. He touched his nose with great delicacy and frowned into the mirror. I miss breakfast, lose a perfectly proficient driver and my best car. I break my nose yet again and get an old raincoat of immense sentimental value, dirtier than it's ever been in its life before, and all you can say is, that's funny? Sorry, Sheradineen. I just mean that's weird. I don't know why they'd do something like that. You are certain it was deliberate? Oh. What was that? Nothing. You are certain it wasn't just an accident? Positive.
I called for a spare car and the police and went back to where it happened. No diversion, all gone. But there were traces of industrial solvent where they'd removed the false red road markings from the top of the storm drain.
Ah, yeah.
Smar's voice sounded odd. He took the transceiver bead off his earlobe and looked hard at it.
Smar? Ooh, yeah. Well, as I said, if it was those two governance bods, the police won't do anything. But I can't understand them behaving like that.
He let the washbowl drain and dabbed tenderly at his nose with a fluffy hotel towel. He put the terminal earring back on his ear. Maybe they just object to the fact I'm using Vanguard money. Maybe they think I'm Mr. Vanguard or something. He waited for a reply.
Smart?
I said maybe they...
Yes, I heard you. You might be right.
Anyway, there's more.
God, what?
He picked up an ornately decorated plastic screen card, which against a background of what looked like a fairly wild party, slowly flashed a message on and off. An invitation to me. I'll read it out. Mr. Stabberind, congratulations on your narrow escape. Do please come to a fancy dress party this evening. A car will pick you up at Rimset. Costume provided. No address. He put the card back behind the washbowl taps. According to the concierge, that arrived at about the same time I called the police after my car went tobogganing.
Fancy dress party, eh?
Smar giggled.
Better watch your ass, Sir Calway.
There was more giggling. Not all of it Smar's. Smar, he said frostily. If I've called at an awkward time...
Smar cleared her throat, sounded suddenly businesslike. Not at all.
Sounds like it was the same lot. You going?
I think so, but not in their costume, whatever that turns out to be.
All right, we'll track you. Are you absolutely positive you don't want a knife missile or...
I don't want to get into that argument again, Dizziot, he said,
dabbing his face dry and sniffing hard again, inspecting himself in the mirror. What I was thinking about was this. If these people did react like this just because of Vanguard, maybe we can persuade them there's an opportunity for them here.
What sort of opportunity?
He went through to the bedroom, collapsed on the bed, staring up at the painted ceiling.
Beishai was connected with Vanguard at first, yes?
Honorary President Director. Gave it credibility while we were starting up. He was only involved for a year or two.
But there is that link.
He swung his legs off the bed and sat up, staring out of the window at the snow-bright city. And one of the theories we believe these guys have is that Vanguard is run by some sort of namby-pamby machine that's developed consciousness and conscience.
Or just by some old recluse with philanthropic intentions, Smar agreed.
So, say this mythical machine or person had existed, but then somebody else got hold of the reins, disabled the machine, killed the philanthropist, and then started spending their ill-gotten gains.
Smar said. She coughed again. Yes? Well, they'd be acting a lot like you've been, I suppose.
So do I, he said, going to the window. He picked up a pair of dark glasses from a small table, put them on. Something beeped near the bed. Hold on. He turned, crossed to the bedside, and picked up the same small device he'd scanned the two top floors with when he'd first arrived. He looked at the display, smiled, and left the room. Walking down the corridor, still holding the machine, he said,
Sorry, somebody bouncing a laser off the window in the room I was in, trying to eavesdrop.
He entered a suite facing uphill and sat on the bed.
Anyway, could you make it look like there'd been some sort of event in the Vanguard Foundation a few days before I arrived here? Some sort of cataclysmic change, but the signs are only appearing now. I don't know what, especially as it all has to be backdated, but something that the markets, say, only just get hold of now. Something buried in the trading figures. Would that be possible?
Smar said hesitantly. I don't know. Ship?
Hello,
the xenophobe said.
Can we do what Zakawa just asked?
I'll listen to what it was, the ship said.
Then...
Yes, best get one of the GCUs to handle it, but it can be done.
Great, he said, lying back on the bed. Also, as of now, and again backdating where we can interfere with computer records, Vanguard becomes an unethical corporation. Sell the R&D department investigating ultra-strong materials for space habitats and that sort of stuff,
Have it pick up stock in companies promoting terraforming. Close a few factories, start a few lockouts, hold to all charitable works, skim the pension fund.
Sir Calway, we're supposed to be the good guys.
I know. But if I can get our governance pals to think I've taken over Vanguard, and I think the way they do... He paused. Smar, do I have to spell it out?
No.
You think they might try and get you to convince Beishai that Vanguard's still doing what we want it to do, and so get him to declare for it?
Exactly.
He clasped his hands under his neck, adjusting his ponytail. This bed had mirrors on the ceiling above, not a painting. He studied the distant reflection of his nose.
Long shot, Sir Calloway,
Smar said. I think we have to try it. It means wrecking a commercial reputation it's taken decades to establish. That more important than stopping the war, is it?
Of course not, but... Oh, of course not. But we can't be certain it'll work.
Well, I say we do it now. It has a better chance than offering the university those goddamn tablets.
You've never liked that plan, have you, Sir Calloway?
Smar sounded annoyed. This one's better, Smar. I can feel it. Get it done now, so they've heard about it by the time I get to the party tonight.
Okay. But that thing with the tablets,
Smar. I've rearranged the meeting with the Dean for the day after tomorrow, okay? I can mention the goddamn tablets then. But make sure all this Vanguard stuff goes through now, all right?
Right, I suppose so. Look, Sir Calloway, something's just come up. Was there anything else?
No, he said loudly.
Oh, great. Right, Sir Calloway. Bye.
The transceiver beeped. He tore it off his ear and threw it across the room. Rampant bitch, he breathed. He looked at the ceiling. He lifted the bedside telephone. Yeah. Can I speak to... Trevo? Yes, please. He waited, dug between two molars with a fingernail.
Yeah, night clerk Trevo. My very good friend. Listen, I'd like a little company, you know?
Indeed. Well, there's a largest tip, if that's right. And Trevo, if she comes with a press pass secreted anywhere, you're a dead man.
The suit was vulnerable to a shortish list of comparatively heavy battlefield weaponry, and not much else. He watched the capsule vibrate its way back under the surface of the desert as the suit clasped itself around him. He got back into the car and drove back down to the hotel, just in time to meet the limousine sent by his hosts for that evening. The cluster's media had been cleared from the hotel courtyard that afternoon, on his instructions, so there was no undignified dive through their lights and mics and questions. He stood, dark glasses in place, on the steps of the hotel as the great dark car, significantly more impressive than the one he'd almost been killed in that morning, he was somewhat disappointed to note, drew smoothly to a halt. A huge man, grey-haired with a pale, heavily scarred face, unfolded himself from the driver's compartment and held open a rear door, bowing slowly. "Thank you," he said to the big man as he stepped into the vehicle. The fellow bowed again and closed the door. He sat back in plushly luxurious upholstery that couldn't make up its mind whether it was a seat or a bed. The car's windows dimmed in response to the lights of the media people as the vehicle exited from the hotel courtyard. He gave what he hoped was a regal wave all the same. The evening city lights streamed past. The car thundered quietly. He inspected a package on the seat, bed, beside him. It was paper-wrapped and tied up with colourful ribbons. "Mr. Stabberind," said a handwritten note. He brought the suit helmet over, pulled carefully on a ribbon, opening the package. There were clothes inside. He lifted them out and looked at them. He found a switch on an arm that let him talk to the grey-haired driver. "I take it this is my fancy dress costume. What is it exactly?" The driver looked down, took something from a jacket pocket, and manipulated it.
"Hello," said an artificial voice. "My name is Mullen. I cannot talk, so I use this machine instead."
He glanced up at the road, then down again at whatever machine he was using.
"What do you want to ask me?"
He He didn't like the way the big guy took his eyes off the road each time he wanted to say something, so he just said, "Never mind." He sat back and watched the lights go past, taking the suit helmet off again. They drew into the courtyard of a large dark house down near a river in a side canyon.
"Please follow me, Mr. Stavarind," Mollin said through his machine.
"Certainly." He lifted the suit helmet and followed the taller man up the steps and into a large foyer. He was carrying the costume he'd found in the car. Animal heads glared from the walls of the tall entrance hall. Mollin closed the doors and led into an elevator which hummed and rattled its way down for a couple of floors. He heard the noise and could detect the drug smoke odour of the party even before the doors were opened. He handed the bundle of clothes to Mollin, keeping only a thin cloak.
"Thanks. I won't be needing the rest."
They went out into the party, which was noisy and crowded and full of bizarre costumes. The men and women all looked sleek and well-fed. He breathed in the drug smoke that wreathed the motley figures about him. Mollin led the way through the crowd. People fell silent as they passed, and a babble of conversation started up in his wake. He heard the word Stavarind several times. They went through doors guarded by men even bigger than Mollin, down a flight of softly carpeted stairs and into a large room walled with glass on one side. Boats bobbed on black water in an underground dock on the far side of the glass, which reflected a smaller but more bizarre party. He peeked under the dark glasses, but the view was no brighter. As on the floor above, people walked around with either drug bowls or, for the especially daring, drink glasses. Everybody was either badly injured or actually mutilated. Men and women turned to look at the new arrival as he followed Mollin in. Some men and women had arms broken and twisted, the bones tearing through the skin, showing whitely under the plain light. Some had huge gashes cut into their bodies. Some had whole areas of their flesh flayed and seared. Some had had breasts or arms amputated or eyes put out, often with the removed article or articles dangling from other parts of their bodies. The woman from the street party came towards him, a hand-wide flap of her belly hanging down over her glistening skirt, her belly muscles rippling inside like dull red glistening cords.
"Mr. Stavarind, you've come as a spaceman," she said.
There was an over-elaborate modulation to her voice he found instantly annoying.
"Well, I've sort of compromised," he said, swirling the cape and fastening it across his shoulders.
The woman held out her hand.
"Well, welcome anyway."
"Thank you," he said, taking her hand and kissing it.
He half expected the suit's sensory fields to pick up a whiff of some deadly poison on the woman's delicate hand and signal danger, but the alarm remained quiet. He grinned as she took her hand away.
"What do you find funny, Mr. Stavarind?"
"This," he laughed, nodding at the people around them.
"Good,"
she said, laughing a little. Her belly quivered.
"We did hope our party might amuse you. Allow me to introduce our good friend who is making all this possible."
She took his arm and guided him through the grisly multitude to a man sitting on a stool next to a tall, dull grey machine. He was small and smiling and kept wiping his nose with a large kerchief, which he stuffed raggedly into his otherwise immaculate suit.
"Doctor, this is the man we told you of, Mr. Stavarind."
"Sincere greetings and things,"
said the little doctor, his face collapsing into a moist and toothy smile.
"Welcome to our injured party."
He waved round the room at the wounded people and waved his hands enthusiastically.
"Would you like an injury? The process is quite painless and causes no inconvenience. Repairs are speedy and there aren't any scars. What can I tempt you with? Lacerations? Compound fracture? Castration? How about a multiple trepanning? You'd be the only one here."
He folded his arms and laughed.
"You're too kind. Thank you, but no."
"Oh, don't, please," the little man said, looking wounded. "Don't spoil the party. Everybody else is taking part. Do you really want to feel so left out? There is no risk of pain or permanent damage of any sort. I have carried out this sort of operation all over the civilized universe and have never had any complaints, except from people who get too attached to their injuries and resist repair. My machine and I have performed novelty injuries and wounds in every center of civilization in the cluster. You may not have this chance again, you know. We leave tomorrow, and I am all booked up for the next 2 years standard. Are you absolutely sure you don't want to participate?"
more than absolutely.
Leave Mr. Stubberind alone, Doctor, the woman said. If he does not want to join us, then we must respect his wishes, must we not, Mr. Stubberind?
The woman took his arm in hers. He looked at her injury, wondering what sort of transparent shielding kept everything intact. Her breasts were frosted with small tear-shaped gems and kept high by tiny field projectors on their undersides. Yes, of course.
Good. Would you wait a moment, please? Please share this.
She pushed her drink into his hand and stooped forward to talk to the doctor. He turned to look at the people in the room. Strips of flesh hung from beautiful faces. Grafted breasts swung from tanned backs. Slender arms hung like bloated necklaces. Chips of bone peeped from torn skin. Veins and arteries and muscles and glands squirmed and sparkled in the plain light. He lifted the glass the woman had given him and wafted some of its fumes into the fields around the helmet neck. An alarm sounded, and a small screen on the suit's wrist revealed the specific poison in the glass. He smiled, pushed the glass through the suit's neck field, and knocked the contents back, then coughed a little as the half-alcohol concoction went down his throat. He smacked his lips.
Oh, you've finished it.
The woman came back to him. She was patting her smooth belly, now whole again, and motioned him towards another area of the room. She donned a small, glittering waistcoat as they walked through the mutilated throng. Yes, he handed her the glass. They went through a door into an old workshop. Lathes and punches and drills stood around under layers of dust and flaking paint and metal. Three chairs stood under a hanging light, a small cabinet beside them. The woman shut the door and waved him into one of the low seats. He sat down, placing the suit helmet on the floor at his side.
Why didn't you come in the costume we sent you?
She altered the lock on the door, then turned to him, suddenly smiling. She adjusted the glittering waistcoat. It didn't suit me.
You think that does?
She nodded at the black suit as she sat down, crossing her legs. She tapped the cabinet. It opened out with chinking glasses and already smoking drug bowls.
I find it reassuring.
She leant over, offering him a glass of gleaming liquid, which he accepted. He settled into the chair again. She sat back too, cradling a bowl in both hands and closing her eyes as she leant over it, breathing in deeply. She flapped a little of the smoke under the lapels of the waistcoat so that as she spoke, the heavy fumes curled back out between the material and her breasts and twisted slowly into her face.
We are so glad you could come, whatever your attire. Tell me, how are you finding the Excelsior? Does it meet with your requirements?
He smiled thinly.
It'll do.
The door opened. The man he'd seen with the woman at the street party and when they had chased him in their car was outside. He stood back for Mollen to enter before him. Then he strode to the remaining seat and placed himself in it. Mollen stood near the door.
What have you been saying? The man asked, waving away the woman's hand with a glass in it. He's about to tell us who he is, the woman said.
They both looked at him.
Aren't you Mr. Stubberind?
No, I'm not. You tell me who you are.
I think you know who we are, Mr. Stubberind, the man said. We thought we knew who you were, up until a few hours ago. Now we're not so sure.
Me? I'm just a tourist. He sipped at the drink, looking at them over the top of the glass. He inspected his drink. Minute specks of gold floated in its glittering depths.
For a tourist, you bought an awful lot of souvenirs that you'll never be able to take home with you, the woman said. Streets, railways, bridges, canals, apartment blocks, stores, tunnels.
She waved her hand in the air to indicate that the list went on.
And that's just in Solitol.
I get carried away. Were you trying to attract attention? He smiled. Yes, I suppose I was.
We heard you suffered an unpleasant experience this morning, Mr. Stubberind, the woman said.
She wriggled down deeper into the chair, drawing up her legs.
Something to do with a storm drain?
That's right. My car was diverted down a spillway from the top.
You weren't hurt?
She sounded sleepy.
Not seriously. I stayed in the car until... No, please.
The hand waved up from the indistinct mass of the chair tiredly.
I have no head for details.
He said nothing. He pursed his lips. I understand your driver was not so lucky, the man said.
Well, he's dead.
He leant forward in his seat. Actually, I thought you people might have arranged the whole thing.
Yeah,
said the woman from the mass of the chair, her voice floating up like the smoke.
Actually, we did.
I find frankness so appealing, don't you? The man looked admiringly at the knees, breasts and head of the woman, the only parts of her still showing above the furry arms of the seat. He smiled.
Of course, Mr. Stabrind, my companion jests. We would never do such a terrible thing, but we might be able to lend you some assistance in finding the real culprits.
Really?
The man nodded.
We think now we might like to help you, you see.
Oh, sure.
The man laughed.
Who exactly are you, Mr. Stabrind?
I told you, I'm a tourist.
He sniffed the bowl. I wandered into a little money recently,
and I always wanted to visit Solitol in style, and that's what I've been doing.
How did you get control of the Vanguard Foundation, Mr. Stabrind?
I thought direct questions like that were impolite.
They are.
The man smiled. I beg your pardon.
May I guess your profession, Mr. Stabrind? I mean before you became a gentleman of leisure, of course.
He shrugged.
If you like.
Computers, the man said.
He had started to raise his glass to his lips, just so he could hesitate, as he now did.
No comment, he said, not meeting the man's eyes.
So, the man said, the Vanguard Foundation is under new management, is it?
Damn right. Better management.
The man nodded.
So I heard just this afternoon.
He sat forward in his chair and rubbed his hands together.
Mr. Stabrind, I don't want to pry into your commercial operations and future plans, but I wonder if you'd give us even a vague idea in what direction you see the Vanguard Foundation going over the next few years, purely as a matter of interest for now.
That's easy, he grinned.
More profits. Vanguard could have been the biggest corp of the lot if it had been aggressive with its marketing. Instead, it's been run like a charity, relied on coming up with some new technological gizmo to restore its position each time it falls behind. But from now on, it fights like the other big boys, and it backs winners. The man nodded wisely. The Vanguard Foundation's been too meek until now. He shrugged.
Maybe that's just what happens when you leave something to be run by machines, but that's over. From now on, the machines do what I tell them to, and the Vanguard Foundation becomes a competitor, a predator, yeah?
He laughed, not too harshly, he hoped, conscious he might overdo this. The man smiled slowly but broadly.
You believe in keeping machines in their place, yes?
Yeah.
He nodded vigorously. Yeah, I do.
Mr. Stabrind, have you heard of Zoldrin Beshai?
Sure. Hasn't everybody?
The man raised his eyebrows liquidly.
And you think?
Could have been a great politician, I suppose.
Most people say he was a great politician,
the woman said from the chair's depths. He shook his head, looking into his drug bowl.
He was on the wrong side. It was a shame, but to be great, you have to be on the winning side.
Part of greatness is knowing that.
He didn't. Same as my old man.
Ah, said the woman. Your father, Mr. Stabrind, the man said.
Yeah, he admitted. He and Beshai, well, it's a long story, but they knew each other long ago.
We have time for the story, the man said easily.
No, he said.
He stood up, putting down the bowl and glass and taking up the suit helmet.
Look, thanks for the invitation and all, but I think I'll head back now. I'm a little tired, and I took a bit of a battering in that car, you know.
Yes, the man said, standing too. We're really sorry about that.
Oh, thanks.
Perhaps we can offer something in compensation.
Oh, yeah? Like what?
He fiddled with the suit helmet. I got lots of money.
How would you like to talk to Zoldrin Beshai?
He looked up, frowning.
I don't know. Should I? Is he here?
He gestured out towards the party. The woman giggled.
No,
The man laughed. Not here, but in the city. Would you like to talk to him? Fascinating fellow, and no longer actively on the wrong side, as it were. Devoted to a life of study these days, but still fascinating, as I say. He shrugged.
Well, maybe. I'll think about it. It crossed my mind to leave after the craziness this morning. Oh, I beg you to reconsider that, Mr. Stabberind. Please, sleep on it. You might do a great deal of good for all of us if you would talk to the chap. Who knows, you might even help make him great.
He held out one hand towards the door. But I can tell you want to go. Let me see you to the car. They walked to the door. Mullen stood back.
Oh, this is Mullen. Say hello, Mullen.
The grey-haired man touched a small box at his side.
Hello, it said.
Mullen can't speak, you see. Hasn't said a word in all the time we've known him.
Yes, said the woman. She was completely submerged in the chair now. We decided he needed to clear his throat, so we took out his tongue.
She either giggled or belched.
We've met.
He nodded to the big man, whose face contorted strangely under the scars. The party in the boathouse cellar went on. He almost collided with a woman who had her eyes on the back of her head. Some of the revellers were exchanging limbs now. People sported forearms or none, begging for drinks to be brought to their mouths, or an extra leg, or had arms or legs of the wrong sex. One woman was parading around with a man in tow who wore a sickly, stupid grin. The woman kept lifting her skirt and displaying a complete set of male sexual equipment. He hoped they all forgot who had what at the end of the evening. They passed through the tame party, where fireworks were showering everybody with cool sparks. They were all laughing at that, and he could think of no other word, cavorting. He was wished farewell. It was the same car that took him back, though it had a different driver. He watched the lights and the city's calm expanses of snow and thought about people at parties and people at war. He saw the party they had just left, and he saw the grey-green trenches with mud-caked men waiting nervously. He saw people dressed in shiny black, whipping each other and being tied up. And he saw people shackled to bedframes or chairs, shrieking, while the uniformed men applied their particular skills. He sometimes had to be reminded, he realized, that he still possessed the capacity to despise. The car powered its way through the silent streets. He took the dark glasses off. The empty city swept past.
Numeral 6.
Once, between the time he'd taken the Chosen across the Badlands and the time he'd ended up broken like an insect in a flooded caldera, scratching signs in the dirt, he had taken some leave, and for a while had entertained the idea of giving up his work for the culture and doing something else instead. It had always seemed to him that the ideal man was either a soldier or a poet, and so having spent most of his years being one of those, to him, polar opposites, he determined to attempt to turn his life around and become the other. He lived in a small village, in a small rural community, on a small, undeveloped, unhurried planet. He stayed with an old couple in a cottage in the trees in the dales beneath the high tors. He rose early and went for long walks. The countryside looked new and green and fresh. It was summer, and the fields and woods, the pathsides and the riverbanks were full of unnameable flowers of every colour. The tall trees flexed in the warm summer winds, leaves bright and fluttering like flags. And water ran off the moors and hills and across the bunched stones of sparkling streams like some clarified concentrate of the air itself. He sweated to the crests of the gnarled hills, climbed the outcrop rocks at their summits, and ran whooping and laughing across the broader tops under the brief shadows of the small high clouds. On the moors, in the hills, he saw animals, tiny ones that darted invisibly into thickets from almost underfoot. Larger ones that leapt and stopped, looked back, then leapt away again, disappearing into burrows or between rocks. Larger ones still that ran flowing off across the ground in herds, watching him, and then became almost invisible when they stopped to graze. Birds mobbed him when he walked too near their nests. Others called out from nearby, one wing fluttering, trying to distract him when he approached theirs. He was careful not to step on their nests.
He always took a small notebook with him on his walks and made a point of writing down anything interesting. He tried to describe the feel of the grasses in his fingers, the way the trees sounded, the visual diversity of the flowers, the way the animals and birds moved and reacted, the colour of the rocks and the sky. He kept a proper journal in a larger book back in his room at the old couple's cottage. He wrote his notes up in that each evening as though filling out a report for some higher authority. In another large journal book, he wrote his notes out again, along with further notes on the notes, and then started to cross words out of the completed, annotated notes, carefully removing word after word until he had something that looked like a poem. This was how he imagined poetry to be made. He had brought some books of poetry with him, and when the weather was wet, which was only rarely, he stayed in and tried to read them. Usually, though, they sent him to sleep. The books he had brought about poetry and poets confused him even more, and he had to continually reread passage after passage to retain each word, and even then still felt none the wiser. He went into the village tavern every few days and played skittle and pebble games with the locals. The mornings after these evenings he regarded as recovery periods and left his notebook behind when he walked. The rest of the time he tired himself out and kept fit, climbing trees to see how high he could get before the branches became too thin, climbing rock faces and old quarries, balancing his way across fallen trees in steep gullies, leaping from rock to rock across rivers, and sometimes stalking and then chasing the animals on the moor, knowing he could never catch up with them, but laughing as he sprinted after them. The only other people he saw in the hills were farmers and shepherds. Sometimes he saw slaves working in the fields, and, very rarely, he met other people out walking. He didn't like to stop and talk to them. The one other person he ever saw regularly was a man who flew a kite on the high hills. They only saw each other from a distance. At first, it just happened that their paths never crossed. But later, he made sure that they didn't meet. He would change direction if he saw the gaunt figure of the man walking towards him, climb up a different hill if he saw the little red kite flying above the summit he'd intended to head for. It had become a sort of tradition, a little private custom. The days went on. He sat on a hill once and saw a slave running through the fields beneath, through the strange slow patterns that the currents in the wind pushed through the golden red pelt of the land. The slave's path left a trail like the wake behind a ship. She got as far as the river, where the landlord's mounted overseer ran her down. He watched the overseer beat the woman, saw the long stick rise and fall, tiny in the distance. But he couldn't hear anything because the wind was in the wrong direction. When the woman finally lay still on the riverbank, the overseer got down off his mount and knelt near her head. He saw something flash, but could not tell exactly what was going on. The overseer rode off. Hobbled slaves came and took the woman away later. He made a note. That evening, after dinner, in the house of the old couple, once the wife had gone to bed, he told the old man what he had seen. The man nodded slowly, chewing on a mildly narcotic root, and spat juice into the fire. The overseer was known to be strict, the old man said. He took the tongue of any slave who tried to escape. He kept the tongues drying on a string stretched over the entrance to the slave's compound at the lordship's farm. He and the old man drank some fierce grain spirit from little cups, and then the old man told him a folk tale. In the tale, a man walking through the wild wood was tempted from the path by some beautiful flowers, and then saw a handsome young woman lying asleep in a clearing. He went to the maiden and she woke. He sat down beside her, and as they talked, he realized that she smelled of flowers, a perfume more wonderful than anything he had ever experienced before, and so intense that he was made dizzy by the heady strength of it. After a while, surrounded by her flowery scent, enchanted by her softly lilting voice and shy demeanor, he asked to kiss her, and finally was allowed, and their kisses grew passionate, and they coupled. But as they did so, even from the first moment that joined them, whenever the man looked out of one eye, he saw the woman change. From one eye, she looked as she had from the first, but looking through the other eye, she was older, no longer just past her childhood. With each beat of their love, she grew older, though only seen through one eye. Through her maturity and late glow and the matron look, to spry, then frail old age. All the time, the man could see her in all her youth by just closing one eye, and certainly could not stop himself from the act they had embarked upon. But always, he was tempted to sneak a look through the other eye and be shocked and amazed at the terrible transformation taking place beneath him. In the last few movements of his knowledge, he closed his eyes, only opening both at the moment of fulfilment, when he saw with both eyes now that he had taken to him a rotting corpse, already known by worms and grubs. The smell of flowers changed in that instant to an overpowering stench of corruption, but in such a way that he knew that it had always smelled like that, and as his loins gave themselves to the corpse, his belly threw out his last meal at the same time. The wood spirit had his life by two strands, therefore, and with both hands took a firm grip of him, unravelled him from the weave of life, and dragged him away to the shadow world. His soul was shattered into a million pieces there and thrown over the world to make up the souls of all pollen flies, which bring new life and old death to flowers at the same time. He thanked the old man for telling him the story and told him some tales he remembered from his own upbringing. A few days later, he was running after one of the small animals on the moor. It skidded on some dew-wet grass and tumbled end over end, finally falling, limbs spread, on some stones, winding itself. He gave a victorious, whooping cry and threw himself forward down the slope towards the animal as it wobbled to its feet. He jumped the last couple of metres, landing with both feet just beside where the animal had fallen. It collected itself and sped off again, unharmed, and vanished down a hole. He laughed, breathing hard, sweating. He stood there, put his hands on his knees and bent at the waist, trying to get his breath back. Something moved under his feet. He saw it, felt it. There was a nest under him. He had landed right on it. The eggs, their speckled shells shattered, spread their fluids over his boot heels and into the twigs and moss. He moved his foot, already sick in his heart. Something black wriggled underneath. It moved into the sunlight. A black head and neck. A black eye staring up at him, bright and hard as a jet pebble at the bottom of a brook. The bird struggled, making him jump back a little, as though he had landed with naked feet on something that stung. The bird flapped hopelessly out onto the moor grass, hopping on one foot, dragging one limp wing after it. It stopped a little way off, sideways to him, and tipped its head, seeming to regard him. He wiped his boots on the moss. All the eggs were smashed. The bird made a small keening noise. He turned away and began to walk off, then stopped, cursed, retraced his steps and stamped after the bird, catching it easily in a storm of squawks and feathers. He twisted its neck and dropped the limp remains into the grass. That evening, he stopped writing his journal and never returned to it. The weather grew humid and oppressive and no rains fell. The man with the kite waved and called out to him one day from the top of a hill. He hurried away, sweating. It was 10 or so days after the incident with the bird that he admitted to himself he would never be a poet. He left a couple of days later and was never heard of again, even though the Lord's Marshal sent word to every town in the land, because the stranger was suspected of being involved in what happened the night he left, when the overseer at the Lord's farm was found trussed in his bed, his face fixed in an expression of darkest horror, and his mouth and throat stuffed with dried human tongues and pieces of blank paper on which he had choked to death. Chapter 9. He slept until after dawn, then went for a walk to think. He left by the service tunnel from the main hotel to the annex and left the dark glasses in his pocket. The hotel had cleaned the old raincoat. He put it on and some thick gloves and wound a scarf round his neck. He walked carefully along warmed streets and dripping pavements and held his head up to gaze at the sky. His breath went before him. Little snowfalls slumped off buildings and wires as the weak sunlight and a mild breeze raised the temperature. The gutters ran with clear water and soggy bergs of bumping slush. Pipes from buildings ran or dripped with the melt, and when a vehicle passed, it did so with a wet hiss. He crossed the road to the other side where the sun was. He climbed steps and crossed bridges. He walked gingerly over icy parts where there was no heating or it had failed. He wished he'd put on better boots. These looked fine, but they didn't have enough grip. To avoid falling, you had to walk like an old man, hands splayed as though trying to grasp a stick, bending at the waist when you wanted to walk straight-backed. This annoyed him, but walking on without acknowledging the changed conditions and slipping on his backside appealed to him even less. When he did slip, it was in front of some young people. He was walking carefully down some icy steps leading onto a broad suspension bridge over a railway junction. The youngsters were walking towards him, laughing and joking with each other. He divided his attention between the treacherous steps and the group. They looked very young, and their actions, gestures and pealing voices all seemed to bubble with energy, suddenly making him feel his age. There were four of them, the two young men trying to impress the girls, talking loudly. One of the girls in particular was tall and dark and elegant in that unself-conscious manner of the recently matured. He kept his eyes on her, straightening his back, and just before his feet went out from under him, felt a slight swagger return to his walk. He crashed down on the last step and sat for a moment, then smiled thinly and got up just before the four young people drew level with him. One of the young men was guffawing, making a show of covering his muffled mouth with a gloved hand. He brushed some snow from the tails of the raincoat and flicked some of it at the young man. They went by and on up the steps, laughing. He walked halfway across the bridge, grimacing at the pain seeping up from his backside, and heard a voice call. He turned around and took a snowball full in the face. He caught a glimpse of them laughing as they sprinted away from the top of the steps, but he was too busy clearing the snow from his nostrils and stinging eyes to see properly. His nose throbbed fiercely, but hadn't rebroken. He walked on, passing an older couple walking arm in arm, who shook their heads and tuttered and said something about damned students. He just nodded to them and wiped his face with a handkerchief. He smiled as he left the bridge, up more steps to an esplanade cut under old office buildings. Once, he knew, he would have been embarrassed at what had happened. Embarrassed at slipping, at being seen to slip, at being hit by the snowball after so gullibly turning round on cue, and at the elderly couple witnessing his embarrassment. Once he might have chased after the youngsters to give them a fright at least, but not now. He stopped at a small hot drink stall set up on the esplanade and ordered a mug of soup. He leant against the stall and pulled off one glove with his teeth. He held the steaming mug in his hand, feeling the warmth. He went to the railings, sat down on a bench, and drank the soup slowly in careful sips. The man in the soup stall wiped the counter and listened to the radio, smoking a ceramic cigarette on a chain round his neck. His backside still ached dully from the slip. He smiled at the city through the steam rising from the mug. Served him right, he told himself. When he got back to the hotel, they'd left a message. Mr. Beishai would like to meet him. They would send a car after lunch, unless he objected. This is wonderful news, Shiradineen. Well, I suppose. You're not still being pessimistic, are you? All I'm saying is, don't get your hopes up. He lay back on the bed, looking at the ceiling paintings, talking to Smar via the earring transceiver. I might just get to meet him, but I doubt I'll have any chance to get him out. Probably find he's gone senile and says, hey, Zakalwe, still working for the culture against these gas heads? In which case, I want my ass hauled out, all right? We'll get you out, don't worry about that. If and when I do get the guy, you still want me to head for the imprint habitats? Yes. You'll have to use the module. We can't risk bringing the xenophobe in. If you do spring Beishai, they'll be on maximum alert. We'd never get in and out without being noticed, and that could swing the whole cluster against us for interfering. So, how far's Imprin by module? 2 days. He sighed. I suppose we can handle that. You all ready in case you can do anything today? Yeah. Capsule's buried in the desert and primed. Module's hiding in the nearest gas giant, waiting for the same signal. If they take the transceiver from me, how do I get in touch? Well, Smar said, much as I'd like to say I told you so and displace you a scout or knife missile, we can't. Their surveillance might just be good enough to spot it. Best we can do is put a microsat in orbit and just passive scan. Watch, in other words. If it sees you in trouble, we'll signal the capsule and the module for you. The alternative is to use the phone, would you believe? There's the unlisted Vanguard numbers you already have.
Zakawe?
Hmm?
You do have those numbers?
Oh, yeah.
Or we've a downlink tap on Solitol's emergency services. Just dial 3-1s and scream Zakawe at the operator. We'll hear.
I am filled with confidence, he breathed, shaking his head.
Don't worry, Sheradanin.
Me? Worry?
The car came. He saw it from his window. He went down to meet Mollin. He'd have liked to have worn the suit again, but doubted they'd let him into their high-security areas wearing it. He took the old raincoat and the dark glasses.
Hello.
Hello there, Mollin. A pleasant day.
Yes.
Where are we going?
I don't know.
But you're driving?
Yes.
Then you must know where we're going.
Please repeat that.
I said, you must know where you're going if you're driving.
I'm sorry.
He stood by the side of the car while Mollin held the door open.
Well, at least tell me whether it's very far. I may want to tell people I won't be back for a while.
The large man frowned, the scarred face creasing in strange directions, unusual patterns. He hesitated over which button on the box to press. Mollin's tongue licked his lips as he concentrated. So they had not literally taken his tongue out after all. He assumed whatever was wrong with Mollin was to do with his vocal cords. Why the man's superiors hadn't just fitted him with an artificial or regrown set he couldn't deduce, unless they preferred their underlings to have a limited set of replies. Certainly they'd have a hard time speaking ill of you.
Yes.
Yes, it's far away.
No.
Make up your mind.
He stood with his hand on the open car door, indifferent to his unkindness to the grey-haired man. He rather wanted to test his inbuilt vocabulary.
I'm sorry.
Is it quite close then, within the city?
The scarred face frowned again. Mollin tutted with his lips and pressed another set of buttons with an apologetic look.
Yes.
Within the city?
Perhaps.
Thank you.
Yes.
He got in. It was a different car to that he'd been in the night before. Mollin got into the separate driver's compartment and belted himself in carefully. He pedalled a gear and drew smoothly away. A couple of other cars followed immediately behind them, then stopped at the entrance to the first street they took outside the hotel, blocking the cars of the pursuing media people. He was watching the small, high specks of wheeling birds when the view started to disappear. At first, he thought that black screens were rising outside the windows behind and to either side of him. Then he saw the bubbles. It was some black liquid which was filling the space between the double layers of glass in the back of the car. He pressed the button to talk to Mollin.
Hey!
He shouted. The black liquid was halfway up the screens, gradually rising between him and Mollin, as well as on the other three sides.
Yes,
Mollin said. He grabbed a door handle. The door opened. A draft of cold air whistled in. The black liquid continued to fill the space between the panes of glass.
What is this?
He saw Mollin carefully pressing a button on his voice synthesizer before the liquid blocked the view forward.
Do not be alarmed, Mr. Stabberind. This is just a precaution to ensure that Mr. Beishai's privacy is respected, said an obviously prepared message.
Okay.
He shrugged. He shut the door and was left in the dark until a small light came on. He sat back and did nothing. The unexpectedness of the blacking out was perhaps meant to frighten him, perhaps designed to see what he would do. They drove on. The yellow light of the small bulb gave a stale, warm feel to the interior of the car, which, although large, was made to seem small by the absence of an exterior view. He turned up the ventilation, sat back again. He kept the dark glasses on. They turned corners, zoomed and dived, boomed through tunnels and over bridges. He guessed he noticed the vehicle's motions more because of the lack of any outside reference. They echoed through a tunnel for a long time, going downwards in what felt like a straight line but could have been a wide spiral. Then the car stopped. There was a moment of silence, then some indistinct noises from outside, perhaps including voices, before they moved forward again a short way. The transceiver jabbed delicately at his earlobe. He pushed the bead further into his ear. X-ray radiation, the earring whispered. He allowed himself a small smile. He waited for them to open the door and demand the transceiver, but the car only moved forward a little again. The vehicle dropped.
Its engine was silent. He presumed they were in a large elevator. They stopped, moved forward again, still silent, paused, then carried on forward and down. This time the spiral was obvious. There was still no noise from the vehicle's engine, so they were either being towed or freewheeling. The black liquid drained slowly from the windows as they drew to a halt. They were in a wide tunnel under long white strip lights. The tunnel extended back until it started to curve, forward until it ended before large metal doors. Mollen was nowhere to be seen. He tested the car door, opened it, stepped out. The tunnel was warm, though the air seemed fresh enough. He took off the old raincoat. He looked at the metal doors. Set into them was a smaller door. There was no handle to pull, so he pushed it, but nothing happened. He went back to the car, found the horns, blew them. The noise crashed into the tunnel, rang in his ears, echoing. He sat in the back of the car. After a while, the woman came through the small door. She came to the car, looked in through the window.
Hello?
Good afternoon. Here I am.
Yes, and still wearing your glasses, she smiled. Please come with me, she said, and walked quickly off.
He collected the old raincoat and followed. Behind the doors, the tunnel went on. Then they came to doors set into the side of the wall. A small elevator took them down still further. The woman wore a straight, all-covering gown in black with thin white stripes. The lift stopped. They entered a small hallway like that of a private house, set about with pictures and potted plants and finished in streaky, smokily smooth stone. A thick carpet smothered their footsteps as they went down some steps and onto a large balcony set halfway up the wall of a large hall. Everywhere else, the hall was covered with books or tables, and they walked down a staircase with books below the wood under their feet, books above the wood over their heads. She guided him round floor-standing bookstacks and led him to a table with chairs around it. A machine stood on the tabletop with a small screen set into it and spools scattered about it.
Wait here, please.
Beishai was in his bedroom, resting. The old man, bald,